kept to themselves. The second floor was populated entirely by old women living alone. Every morning, each of them would leave the building for a daily stroll, taking tenuous steps with the help of a walker or a caretaker. A month after moving into our apartment, I returned home from work early one day to take care of a few errands. I was about to get into the shower when the phone rang. I put on my bathrobe and answered the phone. It was someone from UPS returning my call regarding a wedding gift that had arrived broken. As I was trying to explain that no, I did not have a receipt for the gift, the room started to shake and rattle. The pictures, which Francois had just hung on the wall, crashed to the floor, sending broken glass everywhere. The kitchen cabinets burst open and glasses and dishes flew out, shattering on the tile floor. As disturbing as it is to hear the sound of just one glass shattering, I was now hearing dozens of glass objects breaking in every room at the same time. Having grown up in California, I had always heard about the big one, the inevitable huge earthquake that awaited all of us who chose to live in sunshine instead of reason. I assumed this was it. My first thought was that the building was going to fall. I considered putting on some clothes other than the terry cloth bathrobe I was wearing, but then I thought, who cares? The floor was covered with broken glass, so I grabbed the first pair of shoes I saw, Francois's bunny slippers. I also took a pillow to protect my head from falling debris. As I was about to leave the apartment, I thought of my parents. I had to call them. I picked up the phone, but the line was dead. This disturbed me more than the earthquake itself. My parents are highly evolved worriers. My mother once called me in the middle of the day to tell me to make sure I wear shoes when cleaning the attic because she had just heard about a woman who, while cleaning her attic barefoot, was bitten by a rare brown spider whose venom cut off the circulation to her extremities. Consequently, the woman's nose fell off. It was pointless for me to remind my mother that I do not have an attic. My parents do not limit themselves to worrying about things that have actually happened. Dreams are also fair game. I often get phone calls with detailed descriptions of a dream, followed by, "So naturally, I had to call to make sure you were okay, and there wasn't a reason why I dreamed of you trapped in a canoe with a blue turtle." If worrying were an Olympic sport, my parents' faces would have graced the Wheaties box a long time ago. I tried the phone again, but it was still dead. I left my apartment and started walking down the stairs, holding the pillow on my head with both hands. The quake had activated the fire alarm, so the hallways were ringing. As I reached the second floor, I saw one of the old ladies standing in her doorway, shaking uncontrollably. Her face had no color. My first thought was that this person was about to have a heart attack. "Let's leave the building. There are probably going to be aftershocks," I told her. She just stared at me. I put my arms around her tiny, shaking body and started stroking her head. She was trembling like a little bird. In a thick Eastern European accent, she haltingly told me that she just wanted to go back to her apartment. Still holding and stroking her, I stepped into her apartment and sat down on the sofa. I told her that everything was okay and that we had nothing to worry about. I did not believe a word I was saying, but she apparently did. After a while, the color started slowly coming back into her face. I again suggested leaving the building, but she refused. By the time I decided to leave, she looked normal and was telling me how glad she was that her favorite lamp had not broken. Before stepping out of her apartment, I asked her if I could try using her phone. I picked up the phone and heard a dial tone. I called my parents and was greeted cheerfully by my father, who clearly had not heard about the earthquake. "Baba," I said, "there was a big earthquake, but I just wanted to let you know that I'm okay." "No problem," he answered cheerfully. "How's everything else?" My father was not grasping the gravity of the situation, and I had no idea how to describe the earthquake without the handy Richter scale number. "It was a big earthquake. Everything broke," I told him. "Don't worry," he said. "Things are replaceable." "Just know I'm okay," I said. "I gotta go." As soon as I hung up, I thought that I should also call my in-laws, who at the time were living in Marin County, 45 minutes from San Francisco. Ever since marrying Francois, I had clung to the notion that my mother-in-law, in a moment of enlightenment, would cast aside her prejudices and join Francois and me in celebrating our union. I imagined us preparing elaborate Christmas dinners together and her telling me for the 100th time how narrow-minded she had been before getting to know me. And for the 100th time, I would tell her that I forgave her. I dialed my in-law's number. My mother-in-law picked up the phone. I was pretty sure this would be the moment of bonding. It would go something like this. Oh, dear Firouzeh, this earthquake shook me up and made me realize what a fool I've been. How could I have judged you because of your nationality? What was I thinking? Muslims, Jews, Catholics, we're all the same. Imagine it took me this long to wake up and see that we all laugh the same laughs and cry the same tears. Please forgive me. I got it almost right. My mother-in-law asked whether her china had broken. Before the wedding, François had discovered in his parents' garage two large boxes of Limoges china that had never been unpacked. François had never seen these dishes. He assumed they were yet another box of inherited dishes that his parents owned but had never gotten around to using. He asked his mother whether he could have them. In a rare moment of generosity, she said yes. For weeks following the Loma Prieta earthquake, building inspectors measured the damage and labeled structures with green, yellow, or red stickers. Ours was given a yellow sticker, which, unlike a red sticker, meant that we could return to our homes. However, many repairs needed to be made. The elevator had to be fixed for the elderly residents, but otherwise, we didn't expect much. We had come to accept that our landlord's idea of maintenance was cashing the rent checks. One evening, a few weeks after the earthquake, there was a knock on our door. I opened the door, and standing there was the elderly lady I had met during the earthquake. She was holding a chocolate bundt cake. As soon as she saw me, she burst into tears. Handing me the cake, she took out a wad of tissue and said, "I just wanted to tell you." But she got no further. Her sobs got louder. "I just wanted to tell you," she said again, "that you saved my life. My name is Golda Rubinstein, and you saved my life." She continued to sob. I thanked her and told her that she had actually saved my parents' life, since her phone was the only one working, and she didn't let me finish. "I just wanted to thank you and make sure you knew that you saved my life." I thanked her for the cake again and told her I was glad that she was fine. I also thanked her again for letting me use her phone. For a week after the earthquake, all the phones in our building had been dead. My parents later told me that after my phone call, they had turned on the news and seen the devastation. "Had it not been for your phone call," they always say, "we would have worried ourselves to death." Golda's was the only phone in the entire building that had been working. A month later, Golda made another surprise visit, this time bringing only half a chocolate bundt cake. Once again, I opened my door and she burst into tears. Handing me the cake, she took out a wad of tissue. In between sobs, she said, "I called my son and I says, Yaakov, an angel came to me. An angel saved my life." Listening to her own reenactment of the phone call, she sobbed louder. I thanked her for the cake and told her how grateful I was for what she had done for my parents, but she didn't want to hear any of it. Every month, like clockwork, Golda came to our door with half a chocolate bundt cake, a heart full of gratitude and eyes full of tears. One time, when I wasn't home, she had encountered François and asked him whether he knew that he was married to an angel. She had also told him that he was too skinny and she was going to fatten him up. Fortunately, or unfortunately, I wasn't sure which, my mother-in-law's china had not broken. The earthquake did, however, make her rethink her impulsive burst of generosity. This did not surprise us. I would not be singing Kumbaya with this woman anytime soon. As beautiful as they were, two words now describe these dishes: bad karma. François wanted to give them back and forget the whole thing. I was willing to get rid of them, but I did not want to give them back to his mother. I also didn't want to sell them. I figured their bad karma would extend to any money that we made from them. A home for families of children undergoing long-term treatment at a nearby hospital was having a benefit auction. I contacted the organization. Were they interested in a 70-piece set of antique Limoges? They were. After the auction, we received a letter thanking us for our donation and informing us of the selling price. We were thrilled that somebody now owned a beautiful set of china that came with no strings attached. More important, we were happy to have helped out a family that was dealing with a gravely ill child. And if feeling good wasn't enough of a reward, we were now considered major donors to the organization. For the next few years, we were honored guests at a handful of dinners for major donors, all of which were held at elaborate homes where the paintings on the walls were not reproductions. These were catered events with valet parking. At the time, we owned one car, a Honda with a large ding on the side. I always suggested to François that perhaps we should park our car a few blocks away and walk. François refused, insisting that should he suddenly wake up and find himself a multimillionaire, he would like to think of himself as the type who wouldn't be a slave to status symbols, the type who would still remember the little people and the cars driven by the little people. Plus, he added, maybe the valets will get mixed up and give us a BMW. At these dinners, we met all sorts of people whose names graced museums and large institutions. These were people who had not had a financial worry in three generations. At age 26, François and I were by far the youngest guests. Knowing that our days at these swanky shindigs were numbered, we tried to make the most of them by trying each and every one of the desserts. We never did tell my mother-in-law about the china. She never accepted our marriage. Even the birth of our children did not soften her. We eventually stopped having contact with her. The Limoges set has brought us more joy in its absence than it ever did in our cupboards. Of course, we no longer own a set of china to pass down to our kids, but that's okay. François and I plan on giving our children something more valuable. The simple truth that the best way to go through life is to be a major donor of kindness. We'll tell them that it's possible to own a whole bunch of beautiful, valuable things and still be miserable. But sometimes, just having a recipe for chocolate bundt cake can make a person far, far happier. A nose by any other name. When I was a student at Berkeley, I found myself fascinated by a certain librarian there. This woman had the ugliest nose I had ever seen. It was as if God, in a moment of confusion, had switched her nose with the beak of an exotic bird. I suspected that somewhere deep in the rainforests of Brazil, high in a mango tree, lived a toucan with a human nose. What triggered my fascination wasn't the sheer majesty of the librarian's nose, but her abundant confidence. This woman carried herself like a beauty queen. As I watched her go about her duties in her self-assured manner, I couldn't help but wonder, why doesn't she have a complex? In Iranian culture, a woman's nose is much more than a breathing device. It is her destiny. A girl with an ugly nose learns early on to dream of one thing only, a skilled plastic surgeon. Only the poorest families do not intervene to correct nature's nasal missteps. No amount of charm, talent, or intelligence can make a girl overcome an ugly nose. It simply must be fixed. I am descended from two types of noses. On my father's side, the noses are big, but otherwise perfectly reasonable. God just didn't know when to stop a good thing. The noses in my maternal lineage are all large and hooked. Gonzo on Sesame Street bears an uncanny resemblance to my mother's side of the family. I grew up thinking that it was normal to yell, "Not the profile!" whenever a picture was being taken. Mine is the kind of nose that enabled me to impress fellow high school students with my ability to balance a pencil and eraser between my nose and mouth. This enviable contortion act pretty much sealed my fate as the type of girl who never had to worry about buying a prom dress. When I was small, all eyes were on my nose. I was considered a cute little girl, But whenever anyone commented on my looks, someone, usually my mother, would say, "We'll see." Everyone knew what that meant. History is full of girls who were cute one day, and then boom, the nose grew. And my female relatives had known them all. They continued their nose watch, tracking my rhinal growth like traders tracking stock on Wall Street. By the time I was an adolescent, it was clear that I had been somewhat spared. I had a hooked nose light. I resembled my maternal relatives, but the nose wasn't quite bad enough to invite comparison to a puppet. The consensus among my female relatives was that even though my nose wasn't horrific, it could use a little improvement. You just need the tip removed. When I was 18, my father and I headed off to a consultation with a plastic surgeon, the best in Newport Beach. As I sat in this man's well-appointed office and looked at the expansive ocean view, I wondered how he could take himself seriously. Judging by the framed diplomas all over the walls, he had spent many years studying at prestigious medical establishments. Here was somebody who could be saving a life somewhere, but instead he was looking forward to lopping off the tip of my nose. As he explained the procedure, what bothered me the most wasn't the idea of having my nose broken, but having my nose broken by him. I just didn't respect him enough. My father was relieved that I had decided against a nose job. He thought it was way too expensive. "You can buy me a car instead," I suggested. "Your nose is fine," he replied, "and you don't need a car." Despite the ominous warnings from my female relatives that noses keep growing well into adulthood, I managed to graduate from college, get married, and have children, all with my original nose. I hadn't actually thought about my nasal imperfections in years. After two pregnancies, I had found other body parts far worthier of obsession. I had, however, thought about the toucan. Whenever anyone complained about his nose, I always shared the story of the confident librarian who had overcome her formidable rhinal challenge. Naturally, people wanted to know why she had so much confidence. "I don't know, she just did," I always replied. Little did I dream that I would someday find out. About 20 years after my last sighting of the toucan, François and I and our two kids were on our way to a motel for a week. Our house was on the market, and the real estate agent felt that it would sell more quickly if we weren't in it. Somehow, toys scattered throughout the house and toilets that the little ones had forgotten to flush are not considered a marketing boon. François and I cleaned the house, removed all the extra things we had stuffed in our closets, put fresh vases full of flowers everywhere, and left. We arrived at the local motel just in time to go to bed. While we were putting the kids to sleep, François was called in to work. As soon as he left, every article I had ever read about crimes being committed in motel rooms came flooding back to me. I was convinced that the moment I fell asleep, a disgruntled ex-employee who had managed to keep the master key would come back to avenge himself. I was not going to be able to sleep until my husband returned. Desperate for a distraction, I turned on the TV. Since we don't have a television in our house, I assumed it would be fairly easy to find something entertaining, if only for the novelty. I started flipping channels, avoiding the in-depth profiles of serial murderers, zipping past the sitcoms, past the infomercials selling juicers, past Susan Lucci selling shampoo. Just as I was thinking, "Thank God I don't have a television, so I don't have to watch this crap," all of a sudden, there she was on the screen, the toucan. She looked exactly the same, except for a few more gray hairs. I assumed that this was a show about the Dewey Decimal System or recent donations to the UC Berkeley Library. But suddenly, the camera panned back, and I saw that the toucan was completely naked. My father had always told me that a college education would give me endless opportunities. I never realized that seeing the librarians naked would be one of them. I was intrigued and repulsed at the same time. I looked to make sure my children were sleeping. They were still at the age when they readily announced every detail of our life to perfect strangers. Mommy watches naked women on television might not get them into the best preschools. I hoped that Francois would not come home and think I was hiding some big secret. I sat back to watch the